This is the Kinky Cast, an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 105 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. We welcome guests with opposing viewpoints. Today, our guest is Dr. Dan, with everything you didn't want to know about STIs. Here's your hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome back to another edition of the Kinky Cast. Sitting across the desk, as usual, is the Beast. Hey, Beast.
Hey, Woody. I just had dinner with my dear Anne.
Oh, it's a hard life, and you have to lead it, isn't it?
I know. But I had to tear myself away because we had such a great guest here with us tonight.
Well, duty calls, you know.
Yes, duty calls, and our guest knows about duty very well. Hi, Dr. Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good.
Listeners, you may remember Dan from the Frolicon show back last year.
Yeah. It was the two MDs and a microphone panel that I do. And that was my, I think, fourth year doing it.
And it was a sellout.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a fun event because everybody in the audience gets to write down questions if you're bashful or just ask directly if you're not. That is one of our casts. Go back and listen to that one. We have Dr. Dan on the phone tonight from Atlanta, Georgia, and he is going to bring us a myriad of wonderful medical things.
Absolutely.
I am having flashbacks to the reality shows of The Monster Within. I'm sorry. You know that TLC show?
Oh, God,
yeah.
Yes. Of course. Yeah. That I actually do that, though. That is part of what I do.
Oh, wow.
Explain that to the listeners.
Oh, okay. So The Monster Within from a couple of episodes I see is usually somebody that sometimes they travel to a weird area or, you know, a faraway area like Africa, and they get bitten by a bot fly or they get infected with a guinea worm or some sort of parasite. And then they go down this path of seeing doctors after doctors after doctors, and everyone says, oh, you have X disease, but they never really get to it. And then they see the brilliant infectious disease doctor, and then they say, ah, you are in this endemic area, and I need to check to see if you have, you know, onchocerciasis or something like that. And the show is just fraught with really, really bad George Lucas episode 1-3 CG showing the parasites moving through people's intestines and things like that.
Okay.
Like, really, really bad. So part of what I do is, yeah, people coming to me after traveling or because they've been to a bunch of different doctors and they needed, you know, another opinion or, you know, they're referred to me. If anybody ever watched the show House MD, he was an infectious disease doctor in that show. The character was written to be an infectious disease doctor. The main differences are I don't just go into people's surgeries and do their surgery, and I don't break and enter into people's houses to look under their sink. I only break and enter to take their jewelry and valuables.
Okay.
You took all the fun out of it.
Yeah.
Haven't faked your own funeral yet.
Yeah. No. So when people are in the hospital, you're like, oh, you're in the hospital, huh? Anybody at home? They live alone? Oh, okay.
Not creepy at all, Dan. Here we are in the kinky world. And
yes.
I assume that you are kinky in some form.
Yes, that is correct, actually.
Wow, Dr. Kink.
That's the interesting thing about it. There's probably a lot more people that are in the kink scene, personally in the local BDSM scene here. You're just not going to hear about it very much. There's a lot of pressure to not talk about these things in this field. And I just kind of made a choice because of the field that I'm in to say, hey, look, I am part of it, and I want to see people who are involved in it, and I'm open about it. So I'm also listed on the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom website. I think I'm the only infectious disease provider on there in the U.S. You know, there's a couple of different ways to handle it. The way I've chosen to handle it is a little bit different than most people, but it's actually served me really well.
I do admire and respect your willingness to be open, and because of people like you, we are making some inroads and some changes in the public's attitude to the things that we do.
Absolutely.
And on a personal note, yes, I know a lot of kinky nurses.
Oh, I do too.
Oh, yeah.
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 Wow.
ER and ICU nurses tend to be ER and ICU.
Yeah, actually, that's true.
That's what I have seen, yes.
Yeah.
One of the nurses I knew was a plastic surgery nurse.
Mm.
Very vain people.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
You have worked in the medical field for a long time, so you've seen a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I would say a long time. I've been in the medical field now. I've been in private practice for 2 years. And prior to that, I was in residency and fellowship in Memphis for 5 years. And you definitely see quite a bit there.
So you're saying Memphis is more interesting with a quote?
As far as, you know, weird, messed up diseases that you don't normally see, like, you know, tuberculosis and histoplasmosis from an infectious disease standpoint, but not really kink related.
In your Atlanta practice, you are really specializing in the kink version of medicine.
Yeah, actually, most of my patients that I see in the outpatient setting, I do both outpatient, so seeing patients in a clinic and in the hospital. And most of the patients I see in the outpatient setting are actually mostly homosexual men, but a fair amount of them are in the kink scene, and also heterosexual folks in the kink scene as well.
And what type of scary and sad things bring these people to you?
It's not always scary and sad things. One of the things I really recommend listeners to do is to get tested at least annually for STDs, especially if you're in non-monogamous or poly relationships. Some of it is just coming in for routine testing, and they know they have someone that they can trust and someone that knows the lifestyle well. They can talk to me about things related to the poly or BDSM lifestyle and ask questions.
So it's a lot more comfortable with going to your health department and having these tests done.
It is absolutely 100% so much better to go to a private doctor than to go to the health department. And let me explain why. In the health department, there's a queue. You're going to have to wait probably all day to get tested in a health department. But more importantly is your comfort as a patient is going to be so much better if you get tested through a private physician who is set up to do that testing. For example, if you're a male and you needed to get tested for gonorrhea and chlamydia, if you go to the health department, you will have a wooden cotton-tipped swab stuck up your urethra, and not just a little bit. They really jam it up there to make sure that you think twice before doing anything risky again.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you go to a private doctor, for example, we do a little bit more advanced and up-to-date testing. For example, for gonorrhea and chlamydia testing, we do urine testing, no cotton-tipped swabs up your urethra. That applies to females, too. So if you go to the health department, they're going to stick a cotton-tipped swab up your urethra, and it's not going to be fun. If you have insurance and it does cover lab work, that is part of your annual well visit exam if you are of reproductive age. So make sure when you go in annually that you get these things done.
Now, that brings me to a very interesting question.
Yes.
The lab work that you request from your doctor.
Right.
Are there special things you really need to ask for, aren't they, to get the full screening panel?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Beast, because many people falsely assume, especially folks that go to their annual OBGYN exam, that they say, well, they tell their doctor to test them for everything. Your doctor is actually not testing you for everything. That would be incredibly costly, and they're not going to do it. You have to be very specific what you need to test for. Also, you really shouldn't be testing for everything. A really good example of this is testing for herpes. The herpes rate or the carriage rate in the population is so high that just doing routine testing. So when you do the lab testing, what they're doing is they're looking for antibodies to type 1 and type 2. frequently people are exposed to it, but don't have actual lesions. It's somewhat controversial to do the herpes antibody testing because so many people are positive that it causes them undue stress, even if they don't have the lesions. Now, it can be very handy to know this, and that's something you're going to have to specifically request because most physicians won't check for it unless you had lesions that looked like herpes. You can do the serology test, and you can also do swabs and culture them. But that is one that typically isn't tested because the repercussions of testing it may outweigh the benefits of just knowing it.
So a lot of people will come back and they'll say they have a clean bill of health and they really aren't 100% sure because they can't speak to some of these untested issues that are out there.
Right, right. So the main ones that we're checking for on STD screens, it has entirely to do with what you are doing. You know, this is a good time to tell your doctor and try to have a good relationship with your doctor that you can be honest with him about the things that you're doing. Finding a good doctor is sometimes will take, you know, word of mouth. Sometimes it'll take trying a few different folks. When you find a doctor that you can trust with things that you're doing in your lifestyle, the value of that is innumerable. Let's say, for example, you're a bisexual male. You know, your doctor may only be testing you for diseases that if you're only sexually active with females. There's some thought that if you're, let's say, a bisexual male, you're in a higher risk group if you're having sex with men, especially if you're bottoming to them. Your doctor isn't going to recommend doing, for example, endoscopy screening to look for genital warts or precancerous lesions for rectal cancer if he assumes you're heterosexual. So it's excellent to have an advocate that you can trust with your lifestyle to talk about these things.
Now, is the average GP going to be familiar, or are you going to have to educate them on some of this stuff that there is a different battery of tests for different sexual persuasions?
Absolutely. A good starting point, and I kind of mentioned it earlier, is if you can find a kink-aware physician, there are directories online. I did mention the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom is one of them. If you can find a kink-aware or kink-knowledgeable physician, you definitely will have the upper hand. In other cases, doctors love to be educated about these things. They want to know more about you. They do care about you. And they want you to have the best possible outcome. So coming to your doctor and explaining, look, I'm in this lifestyle. These are the things that I do. And these are the things that I think I'm at risk for. And even if you didn't do the research, just telling your doctor some of the sexual practices you do will help them kind of bring into mind, we need to do this specific testing. Alternatively, if you see a infectious disease doctor instead of a general practitioner, especially one that does a lot of HIV treatment, they're probably going to be very aware of what they need to test you for. And I think in general are a little bit more aware of lifestyle choices and the different lifestyle choices out there.
Because that's their patient base and they're exposed to these conversations repeatedly and often.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned the HSV2 herpes. How common is that? I hear that's a huge misperception by the general public, I think.
As far as the misperception goes, yeah. So HSV1 and 2 can both cause genital lesions. I think that's a very large misperception. The biggest difference between HSV1 and 2 is in the degree of severity and recurrences of it. So HSV2 tends to reoccur more often, tends to be a little bit more severe than HSV1. But you can get HSV1 or 2 in the oral or genital regions. And the other thing to take into consideration too, and talking to your doctor about that, is you can be exposed and have the virus without ever having lesions. And even if you don't have lesions, you can still transmit the disease. That's a big reason why it's so common. And that's a big reason why we don't do the serological testing, is because between HSV1 and 2, the prevalence of it is almost estimated between 40 and 60% of the U.S. population.
your odds are more likely than not that you've been exposed if you're a sexually active adult.
Right. If you're not having lesions and you've had multiple sex partners, it may not be worth your while to get tested for herpes. If you are having lesions and there's a question, is this herpes? Then yeah, it's worth getting tested for that. But otherwise, you're not going to start suppressive therapy with something like Valtrex unless you're having recurrent outbreaks. Knowing doesn't really help you very much. And it actually can cause a lot of harm, knowing that.
Dr. Dan, let's talk about the lesions. You're talking about genital lesions or oral or both?
Both.
And so in the case of oral, we're just talking about cold sore-looking things.
Right. I mean, it can frequently look like cold sores, and cold sores can be either herpes simplex 1 or 2. I think that's a big misconception, is that cold sores, type 1, stick to the mouth, and then, genital herpes is type 2 and stick to the genital area. That's not entirely true.
From what I understand, this is not a disease of a great concern because it has such a low impact on overall health.
I wouldn't say that, actually. I think herpes has a great emotional impact on the people that have it, especially people who have recurrent lesions. And you can get complications from herpes outside of the occasional sores. One of the things I see, and I see it because I'm the one called when people do come down with it, is you can actually get a meningitis syndrome from herpes, and it can come back frequently. Like you can get a recurrent meningitis from herpes, and it's called Mollaret syndrome. And I've seen it a few times already. So whenever I see meningitis in someone that's of a young age, when I say young age, I mean someone in their young adult life or adult life.
Wow.
So yeah. Cool stuff that you didn't know.
Yeah.
New information.
Yes.
Now, what the traditionals? Gonorrhea, syphilis, and so forth. Chlamydia. What are those growing or shrinking or?
On the rise.
On the rise.
Absolutely. And it does depend on what area of the country you're in, and a lot of this is due to ignorance, and a lot of it is due to access to healthcare. People not having access to healthcare. People feeling ashamed about their lifestyle choices or their sexual preference. And not getting tested, all of those things you just mentioned, highly, highly, highly infectious. And in the case of syphilis, depending on what kind of sexual practices that you do, you may not even know that you're infected with it. Especially in females with gonorrhea and chlamydia, they may not necessarily have any symptoms.
Wow.
That is the importance of getting tested annually, because especially in terms of things like gonorrhea and chlamydia, if you let it go on too long, and especially if you're a female, increases your risk of getting pelvic inflammatory disease and may down the road impact your ability to reproduce.
Now, at what point do you recommend more than annual testing for people? We know that sex workers and so forth have a even monthly testing criteria. But
right.
For the average person.
Or the average listener of your podcast.
Oh, right? Okay. Pretty much the same group, right?
Yeah, that's probably the same group. Absolutely. A couple very important things to consider for your listeners. And I don't mean to be the whole buzzkill or Dr. Fun Killer here, but some diseases have window periods where even if you test negative, you still can be infected with it and you still can transmit it. HIV is one of those. If you go to an infectious disease provider versus a health department, this is another reason to go to someone that is doing current generation testing. HIV testing keeps on evolving. And one of the ways it's evolving is in the window period after you acquire HIV, that the test will be negative even though the person's positive for it. Traditionally, the window period could be up to 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, approximately eight being really the latest. But with current generation testing that we have, we can get results back, i.e., if you're positive or not, within 2 to 4 weeks of exposure, which is huge, huge. Yeah, so it's quite a big difference. And then regarding your question of how often should someone be tested, it is completely individualized and based on risk. If you're doing it monthly, if you're a commercial sex worker, yeah, monthly is fine. But, you know, if it's something that's concerning, or if the person that you're having sex with have a known STD, or they tell you, hey, look, you know, I'm being treated for syphilis right now, you really, really, really need to be screened immediately. Because one of the things that I see frequently is folks that I'm treating for one of those diseases, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, and I treat them, and we bring them back for retesting, and they're still positive. And it's not because the treatment didn't work. It's because their partner or partners reinfected them.
So this is important to have the awkward but very important conversation with your partner.
Or partners, yeah.
Or partners. Absolutely. And that could become a very huge involved circle in some cases.
Exploring the whole tree.
Well, poly is all about communication. And this has to be part of it.
What about prevention? Just to touch on that lightly, safer sex practices, barriers, and so forth are important. What about the dental dams and so forth? Are they underutilized, or are they being appropriately used, or what do you think there?
Well, Beast, I have a lie detector question that I use with my patients the first time that I see them. When I ask them about condom use, and if they tell me that they use condoms every time, 100% of the time,
oops.
I ask them if they use condoms with oral sex, and if they say yes, I know they're lying. Because very, very, very few people use condoms with oral sex. In truth of my patients, how many of them I believe it? I would say maybe one or two to date. Only one really sticks in my head right now. Using barrier protection for oral sex is typically very underutilized in the community.
But many of these diseases can be found in the throat, if I understand.
They can be transmitted orally. That's right. So this is yet another reason why you want to have a provider that knows about, or you can inform about, the lifestyle and that you can trust about it. Because when it comes to testing, especially for things like gonorrhea, you have to swab everything that's participated or penetrated. The two P's. That may mean getting your rectum swab, getting the back of your throat swabbed. Let's say you have a fun little night and maybe blow somebody that has gonorrhea. Well, you're going to have gonorrhea in the back of your throat, but if they do conventional gonorrhea testing, i.e. a urethral swab or a urine DNA test, it will come back negative, despite the fact that you have gonorrhea at the back of the throat.
And that will just stay there and develop and all that?
That's right. Yeah. So it's actually a very, very, very frequent cause of sore throat in young adults and adults.
More information here.
Yeah,
it sounds like you have a little sore throat there.
Yeah.
Why are you looking at your insurance card right now?
Treatments have advanced now, haven't they?
Oh my God, yes. For the basic things that you mentioned, syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia, the treatments have been pretty much the same for many, many, many years. But for HIV, on the other hand, the treatments are so much better than what we've had. Even in the last 5 to 10 years, the treatments have advanced so much. Whereas before, when most people think of HIV, they think of a kitchen table just covered with pill bottles and having to take multiple medications and some sort of almost like a chemo cocktail of medications with a lot of side effects. But most of my patients now are on one pill, once a day medications with almost no side effects and are undetectable of the virus.
Does that promote riskier behavior?
Okay, so that's a good question too. If you're undetectable with HIV, what I mean by undetectable is when we take a blood sample, we're looking at the amount of virus per milliliter of blood. And for all those not familiar with metric, a can of Coke is 355 milliliters, more or less. I don't have a can of Coke in front of me. So just divide that can of Coke by 355. And the amount of HIV virus in 1 milliliter to be undetectable has to be less than 50. Why we try to get people undetectable is a couple reasons. The biggest reason why we try to get people undetectable for HIV is that the transmission risk of when you're undetectable is fairly close to zero. It's not an absolute zero, but it's very close to it. Meaning you're less likely to get HIV from somebody that has an undetectable HIV viral load than someone who just hasn't been tested recently, which to most people is completely mind-blowing.
Yeah, that is counterintuitive.
Yes. So one of the things I do when I see HIV patients to start with is reassurance and saying, look, this isn't the end of your life. And more importantly, this isn't the end of your sex life.
Now, what about the new partner drug that we've heard about for HIV?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's something called PrEP. We call it PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Right now, there's only one medication that's approved for it. It's called Truvada, and that is soon to change, probably in the next year. In the next year, I think there's going to be multiple options that we have for pre-exposure prophylaxis, possibly even what we call depot injections, meaning you just go to your doctor and you get a shot, and it will last for somewhere between 1 and 3 months. Here's the thing about pre-exposure prophylaxis. You've been hearing a lot about it probably in the last year, and it sounds like it's a new breakthrough or something that's just been discovered. But the reality is we've known about it for a couple of years now. Just the physician community hasn't been that excited about it. And there's a couple of reasons why. One of them is really ignorance in it, knowing that you can use these medications for pre-exposure prophylaxis. A lot of physicians are, especially if it's a general practice physician, if you're in a small town, you may not have access to an infectious disease doctor. And it's always a good idea to find out in your community, especially if you're in a smaller town, who sees HIV patients? Because if you're in a smaller city or suburb, it's probably fairly limited. And you definitely want to see them if you do have HIV or if you want to talk to them about pre-exposure prophylaxis, because they're going to know more about the medications, they're going to know more about the side effects of it. But part of the reason the physician community didn't get terribly excited about it, it does work very well. That's the positive. The risk reduction is about 93%, which is fantastic and can be used in addition to condoms for a greater degree of HIV risk reduction. I think a big reason why people didn't get terribly excited, and there is even some stigma against PrEP in the gay community, is because some people tend to go buck wild while they're on it. I.e. saying, hey, I'm on this medication that prevents me from getting HIV. I can have, you know, I can bear back and get cream pie gangbanged. You know, nothing's going to happen to me. But the reality is you're just as high of a risk of getting, it doesn't protect you against gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, HPV and herpes, hepatitis C, all these other wonderful things.
So that means out of your 100, your odds are 7 of them are still high risk with a 93%.
Right. A couple of reasons why it's not 100% active against HIV. It's a few different reasons. One, people don't necessarily take it correctly. Some people take it as a party drug. They take it. Yeah, that's that, which is not the correct way to do it. You have to take it daily. So that is a big part of it. And then the other part of it is some rarely, but it does happen. People will have their HIV virus that they have will have a mutation that will make it not sensitive to Truvada. If that's the case, and the person that you may be acquiring HIV from, if their virus has a mutation that makes it resistant to that pre-exposure prophylaxis medicine, it's probably not going to work very well.
Again, it's Russian roulette then.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a big reason why I think physicians haven't really gotten very excited about it, is because it's not an absolute risk reduction. Some believe that it does lead to a little bit more riskier behavior. I'm not familiar with any studies that have shown it. However, you know, folks like myself actually do use it quite a bit, especially in folks that are in monogamous or relatively low partner relationships where one person is negative and the other person is positive. As I like to tell my patients, I choose to believe that we live in a world where people like to smoke, like to drink, and nobody gets excited about condom use. That's why, you know, I want them to be honest about that and say, you know, it's perfectly okay to tell your doctor you don't use condoms, and then we need to work with you to come up with a good option. I think a big reason I do what I do is because so many of my friends and close people I consider family, went to their doctor and they were just judged by their doctor and said, you need to stop having sex with multiple partners and you know, what you're doing is risky or dangerous. They were just there to judge them and not willing to work with them.
And they add immoral and unlawful and non-Christian right. to that.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Eventually, we're going to get off the STD topic and we need to talk about mandatory reporting for sure.
Yes.
When it comes to BDSM.
Let's move here into a new area. You're a doctor.
Yes.
Doctors have laws that apply to them.
That's right.
And you're talking about going to your GP, finding a GP, and being candid with them. And STDs are kind of a old thing. We've had them for a long time. But now when you go in and you talk about the bruises you have.
That's right.
That's a more new topic.
That's right. Absolutely. And a very important thing to remember is physicians and emergency medical staff are what we call mandatory reporters. So they are obliged to talk about and report any signs of abuse. Something to definitely consider if you do need to make a trip to the emergency room. And I highly, highly, highly recommend everybody to actually check out the Kinky Cast from Lady Steel. That was recorded at Frolicon, and you guys can chip in which episode number that is.
That's episode 79, July 31st, 2015.
She does such a fantastic job, and she's another excellent member of the kink community that is a professional, in her case, an attorney. And she goes into great detail about a couple of the steps that you need to know before you get into these things. It's a very tricky subject, and there's not really a great answer for it. The best thing you can do, and I believe this was her advice as well, is if they do ask you the questions, you don't have to tell them how it happened. Just tell them the medically necessary or relevant facts. You don't have to say, I bust out my 4-foot cricket bat, and you know she was being a brat. She was going to get it either way. You don't have to tell them that they got hit with a 4-foot cricket bat.
And the part that the brat, and she's going to get it, wouldn't put anybody at ease there.
Yeah, there's an intent thing there.
Right. You absolutely do not need to say that. You're under no legal obligation, nor is the person in, you know, the emergency setting obligated to tell them the specific details of it. But if you do, they do have an obligation to report that. You know, should give you pause. However, I would never leave out medically relevant information. If it's something that's going to help the doctor with the treatment of it, I mean, you can use broad generalities like saying, you know, she suffered an impact to her behind and that's it.
Impact to her behind.
There you go. You know, but it's not always bruising. And I haven't went back and listened to my own 2MDs and a microphone kinky cast because I hate hearing the sound of my own voice. But one of the things I talk about in my class, and it's sort of the one thing that you probably shouldn't be doing in play. The thing that always makes me really nervous, it's not fire play. It's not needles. That doesn't make me nervous. Breath play is what makes me extremely nervous as a physician, because the opportunities for things to go wrong in breath play are more than just choking somebody out. If the person is of older age or maybe has problems with cholesterol or heart disease, there's always the possibility that they could have plaques, or that's the fancy medical term for like cholesterol blockages is sort of what the people know it as, in their neck veins, the vasculature of the neck. And if you, while doing some impromptu breath play, maybe dislodge a little thrombus or a little blood clot, and you could stroke them out or potentially kill them. The opportunities for bad things to happen during breath play are innumerable. And if something does happen, you really aren't protected legally, even if it was consensual. That's why I tell people, you're never really going to be an expert at breath play. And for God's sakes, if you're just starting, you may want to avoid breath play. That's my one fun killer thing. If I'm going to kill your fun for one thing,
it's going to be breath play.
I'm happy it's breath play. You know, go out and fuck without condoms. That's fine. It's not fine, but breath play. Yeah.
If you're grading on a curve.
Yeah, I would say breath play is probably the single riskiest thing that you can do in any sort of play.
Well, and I've always said rope in general can be a very risky area.
Everything can be risky.
So you're saying, if I read between the lines here, that when you get your GP and you are comfortable with them, that you may want to start talking about some of your activities, and so that when you do come in, that you have already had this conversation and they realize this is a long-term part of who you are and mm-hmm. not some abusive relationship gone wrong.
Yeah, that I think that actually will come in a lot of handy down the line. Now, keep in mind, your GP is probably not the one you're going to be seeing if you have an accident happen. You're going to be seeing emergency medical staff or going to an ER. Your GP isn't going to be the one seeing you, so they're not going to be there to say, hey, look, it's okay. I know this was consensual. So keep that in mind. Another important thing to keep in mind, too, is frequently physicians are affiliated with hospitals. And if they are, they may have a shared medical record. So if you're open with your GP, but let's say you also see, you know, an endocrinologist or a cardiologist in the same hospital, and your GP may document these things that you're talking to him about. So it's important to know that your other doctors that you may be seeing may also have access to those records.
So that little special smile you get from your urologist, maybe because right. they found something in the file.
Yeah, not to mention right. the nurse that took you back there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, due to HIPAA, the amount of people that can read your medical record is actually, it's fairly limited, and it's very, very, very well regulated because the fines are so high. Most modern, I can't say all of them, but most modern electronic medical record systems have a instant alert function if someone that is unauthorized is viewing the medical record. However, I did mention that other doctors can see medical records, but if you are the type of person that does not want this to happen, and I think this would be incredibly invaluable to your listeners to know this, frequently in most electronic medical record systems, they actually have the equivalent of a sort of like a do not track in it. In one of the more common ones, medical systems, it's called Epic Medical System, used frequently in a lot of hospitals and offices. They have something called breaking a window. And what that is, you can request to have your record password protected. If somebody is looking at your chart, they have to input a code, and then they have to put a reason why they're looking at your chart. So this, if you're someone that is in the public eye or is concerned about your privacy, let's say you're a school teacher or in a profession which could be potentially damaging, if they knew about your involvement in the lifestyle, I highly, highly recommend anyone that is seeing a physician in a medical system, especially if they're seeing more than one doctor in that system, to implement the stronger encryption on your medical record by having a window break or whatever they call it in the different electronic medical records. But you have to request that. That is an opt-in. It is not on by default.
Again, the patient needs to research and be informed about what's the possibilities and what their treatment options and how all this is handled.
Right. But the patient ultimately has control over who sees their medical information. And don't think a lot of people know that. So I think that's incredibly valuable to your listeners to know that.
Most of us just sign the paper at the bottom and move on.
Right. You just sign the consent form. Absolutely. That actually brings up another important thing, and you may want to add this into the previous part about STDs. You also have to look on a state-by-state basis on HIV testing. Some states do not require your personal consent to check for HIV, while other states do. Meaning, if you go to the doctor and ask for an STD test, and you live in a state where you have to sign a consent form for testing, and you didn't sign that consent form, they didn't test you for HIV.
Wow.
So make sure before you get tested that you look up, are consent forms required for HIV testing in your state? Because it varies on a state-by-state basis.
that's really good to know, because you could assume a lot more than is the case. And often doctors just call and there was no problems.
Right. And it's really a holdback on the time where HIV was a fatal diagnosis or highly stigmatized to the gay population, which is why a lot of these states adopted the consent form for treatment.
And I'm not sure that our native Tennessee doesn't have that form. I think that we may have to sign off on that every time.
I believe you do.
I'll have to check with my GP and make sure that we're getting that test done.
I know that I have to be very specific with my doctor. I have to lay out exactly what tests I want.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing, I think it's kind of a misconception. Doctors love when patients ask questions, just not in an authoritative manner. Doctors hate it when you bring in a checklist and something from WebMD and say, look, I have these symptoms and I think I have this and you need to prescribe me this. That's kind of our worst nightmare. But, you know, if you're asking your doctor questions and understand, we're not going to know everything. We'd love to be educated on these things. I don't know any doctor that's going to say, oh, you're in the kink lifestyle. I don't want to know more about that. You do sort of have to be careful. Some physicians will fire you if they consider your lifestyle to be an absolute detriment to your health. Physicians can fire you.
I know that my GP, she raised the eyebrow, she smiled, and she moved on.
I get the eyebrow raised, too, when I ask for my twice annual STD test.
It was mine when I told her, I'm very sexually active. I have multiple long-term partners. And she cocked her head, and we went on. I think I was the first openly poly patient she had run into. Dr. Dan, as we bring this to a close, you've been great. What's the weirdest sexual injury you have run across?
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. That is a good one. Sexual injury I've run across. Okay. I would say it is the mason jar up the ass. Why would someone have a mason jar up their ass? That is a good question. This is a mason jar with the lid off.
Ooh.
Okay. So the lid off. So you shove that thing opening end first in, and it creates a suction. So what this person was doing is they had partially inserted it, and were kind of pulling on and off on it and getting that nice little suction there, and then it got stuck. So they went to their emergency room with a glass mason jar stuck in their ass, and this is a huge problem because if the mason jar breaks when you're trying to remove it, you're gonna cut open their rectum or colon. You're going to have what we call peritonitis, which means you got bacteria in a sterile space, i.e. your abdominal cavity, and blood. And that could rapidly deteriorate and potentially be fatal. Okay? So big problem. The way the emergency room doctors solved this was they passed a Foley catheter. Some of you may know a Foley catheter is a catheter that they insert in your urethra to empty out your bladder, and some people use it for fun. But here's the thing. A Foley catheter has a balloon on the end that you inflate with saline. So what we did is we passed this little skinny catheter past the mason jar and blew the balloon up to break the suction on it. And then from there, we were able to real carefully take the mason jar out. The problem happened when they left the mason jar in the room and everybody left the room. And then we went back to check up on the patient, and he stuck it back up his ass.
He didn't.
Oh, you're kidding.
And he said, get it again.
Oh, no.
Oh, well, okay.
So that did happen, yeah.
Okay, that's amazing.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a good time to tell your listeners, if they have any, you know, specific medical questions related to kink or BDSM, there's a couple good ways, I think, to get a hold of me. You know, we can always, you know, maybe a good way would have them to email you guys, and then we can always do a follow-up episode or like
absolutely.
A little update.
That would be great, yes.
Yeah.
We have our normal questions at kinkycast.com.
Yeah. I think that's a good way. Say, question for Dr. Dan or ask Dr. Dan. You can always come by and see me at Frolicon. I plan on doing my two classes again with Dr. Peggy Sue, who is another kink knowledgeable doctor who I actually trained with. We do two classes, the two MDs and a microphone class, which you can hear the episode that was recorded for Kinky Cast.
Number 75, July 3rd, 2015.
A fantastic episode, if I do say so myself, even though I haven't actually listened to it. I was there. You can always come see me at Frolicon, or if you perhaps are in charge of programming for another kink convention, BDSM convention, poly convention, and you want me and Dr. Peggy Sue to come by and do a talk or two, you can always get in touch with me personally on FetLife under the username Booty Pounder, all one word, spelled like it sounds.
Booty Pounder.
Yes.
Good to meet you, Booty Pounder.
And those links will be on the show page on kinkycast.com.
Get in touch with me. I may not respond to all the friend requests, but you can always shoot me a message, especially if you're interested in me, kind of coming to talk and doing our question and answer session. If you like what you hear in the 2MDs and the microphone podcast, we do a very lively show. We love doing it.
It's fun. Absolutely.
Yeah, Peggy and I love doing it. We love the challenge of these questions, and it really kind of goes to show us how little we think about these things and how little we consider some of these circumstances. We love to hear from you. That would be fantastic.
Well, Dr. Dan, mm-hmm. want to thank you for joining us this wonderful evening.
I have thank you
been
very much.
Educated.
Yes, we learned a lot this time.
Awesome.
Look forward to talking to you in the future.
And we will see you at Frolicon.
Yeah, see you at Frolicon. Look forward to being on the show again.
You have been listening to episode 105 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we bring Linworth to our kinky microphone. She will talk about rope bottoming and the L word.